When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Before you hear the next great podcast, we'd like to tell you about a new 90-second show which distills everything that President Donald Trump has said in the last 24 hours.
You're going to lose a number of people to the flu.
It's called What Has He Said Now? And is available at wherever you get this podcast.
Death totals, or numbers per million people, are really very, very strong. We're very proud of the job we've done.
Look for a link in this here podcast description, or search for What Has He Said Now in all the usual places.
And welcome to Footballistically Arsenal. I'm Boyd Hilton, and I'm joined by psychic Josh Landy. Hi, Josh.
Boyd, we're actually able to see each other for the first time in these lockdown podcasts. You're wearing Supreme. I assumed you would be anyway, but now I have confirmation.
Yeah.
Thanks for turning off your TV. You just tried to start this with your TV.
I forgot to turn off my TV. If Boris Johnson is about to face, we should say this is 7 o'clock Monday evening, and Boris Johnson is about to face the press, and it's quite an exciting moment. But we're doing a podcast about Arsenal, which is much more important, because we didn't do one last week. Apologies to our loyal listenership. We didn't do one last week, and I think that was amazing. I feel we do. Like, this should be a staunch weekly podcast, and due to our own laziness, my laziness mainly, we didn't get a good enough guest, and so we did. It could just be us two chatting away, by the way. Maybe next time we'll do one. We've never done one, us two chatting away, have we?
You know, I remember you did one just you and Alan Alger last
year. Yeah, it went quite well, me and Alan, yeah. It could just be, anyway, this week we have got a good enough guest. Thank God for that. In the shape of Adrian Clarke. Welcome, Adrian.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, well, I hope I can live up to being a half-decent guest for you. Boris can wait, can't he?
Yeah, he can.
He'll still be banging on by the time we've finished anyway.
Exactly, yeah. He probably will be, yeah. He's been banging on all day and not making any sense. That's my own. I won't ask you to comment on that as a professional broadcaster. And we should say Adrian, of course, is the former Arsenal player, first of all, presenter, pundit, and tactics analyst, particularly for Arsenal. And you've been doing, Adrian, interestingly, there's a whole, obviously, in this weird viral period, as I'm calling it, Josh and I have been doing this podcast, and we've tried to get interesting people to talk to them, guests, Arsenal fans, talk to them for about an hour about stuff, and constantly talking about what's going to happen with football, which we'll get to in a minute when it comes back. And people have been showing a lot of old matches, haven't they, on TV. This weekend we had the 79 Cup Final on ITV at 5 o'clock on Saturday, which is quite prime time, I think. I watched it. We had the 89 film on Friday night. I watched that for about the fifth time. And you are also doing retro match analyses, aren't you? And how is that going? And are you enjoying that? And is that kind of helping your period of dealing with the virus, helping you kind of do stuff?
Oh, it's helping me massively. Yeah, look, it's been in the pipeline for ages, actually. Myself and the team at Arsenal discussed doing classic breakdowns with classic matches, and we've never had the time. And of course, now we've got all the time in the world, haven't we? Well, I haven't personally with a 2- and a 4-year-old, but in terms of no live football going on, we have to fill the gap, don't we? And it's been a real treat, let me tell you. So far, I did the Liverpool game 4-2 from the Invincible season, which was incredible in terms of Henry's hat-trick and Ljungberg and Perez. I did the 94 Cup Winners' Cup final, which I'd been at as sort of part of the extended party. I wasn't in the squad, right. But we sort of flew over and for the day. And I went with my dad and the sort of other pros on the periphery, and I'd never watched the game since because I watched it that night. It was fantastic, and never saw it again. I just remembered it in my own mind, and then I got to watch it for Arsenal, which was great. And then I recently did the game where Wiltord scored the winner in 2002, which all of them for different reasons were fascinating to watch and hopefully interesting for the viewers to watch in terms of the analysis.
Adrian, just on the Copenhagen one, looking back at it and remembering that midfield three that played on the night of Selle, Morrow and Davies, and Selle could have only been a bit older than you.
Yeah.
Did you, that must have been slightly aspiring that there was a potential route through, or did you just think actually there's a lot of injuries here?
Well, it was George Graham, and George was very defensive, wasn't he? And I was a bit of a fancy Dan winger that didn't always get back as well as I should have done, I guess. So I think I was always up against it under George. I played, he liked me, but I think his caution would have precluded someone like me 9 times out of 10. But Selle was a really good defensive midfielder, wasn't he? And he was all about breaking up play, really efficient. Yeah, he was a year older than me in sort of school age. He had played, hadn't he? I think he'd been involved in the 93 finals. I think he'd been on the edge of that squad. So he'd got promoted really, really early, which is a surprise to a lot of the lads, not because he wasn't a good player, but because Paul Reid and Paul Shaw were the stars of that age group. I don't know if you remember those two names. Well, obviously,
I remember Shaw. Paul Shaw scored home and away against Southampton. I remember.
Yeah, sure, he got into the first team. Paul Reid never did, but they broke all sorts of records. And Selle was the kind of quiet guy. But yeah, he came in and he was reliable, absolutely reliable. And it was just such a shame that he picked up so many injuries so young, because he could have had a fabulous career as that sort of...
He was a very George Graham player, wasn't he? Did what the boss wanted him to do, very effective. Yes. Yeah, as you say, kind of breaking things up in the midfield and stuff.
He was nothing fancy with the distribution. But that midfield, we looked at it on paper ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Selle, Morrow, who hadn't been a regular, I think Selle was 19. Morrow hadn't played much that season. And Paul Davies, who was obviously a legend, but was asked to play on the right of a three, which is sort of alien to him because he was so left-footed. But yeah, it was crazy. And they sort of went man-to-man. And they just fought like lions, those three, as did the whole team that night. It was great to watch a game from that era, actually, in an analytical type of way. It's changed. Football has changed a lot since 1994.
Is it hard when you're doing a game from that era? I mean, obviously, statistics have changed, haven't they, completely? Because now you have statistics on everything in every game. Every minute detail is counted by someone in Opta or whatever. But back then, it wasn't like that, was it? I don't even remember assists being a thing back then. So is it hard for you? Do you have to like really watch the whole game all over again and do your own like statistical analysis?
No, well, luckily we struck a deal, I think, with Opta, who basically did bespoke stats for us for all of these classic breakdowns. So yeah, it was a sort of part of their sort of deal with Arsenal over the season. They agreed to do some. I don't know if it costs anything or not on top, but yes. Yeah, so their team watched it as if they'd watch it live and gave it almost a full treatment. It wasn't quite as much as what we'd get for a Premier League game, but yeah, which is why if you notice on the breakdowns, I've instead of doing the normal two, I've milked it. I've got three or four different stat sections just to sort of get our money's worth. But and also because these stats didn't exist before now, so it was fascinating.
What I loved was when you were doing that Copenhagen game and you refer to the most successful past partnership between two players as being David Seaman and Alan Smith being 17 times. I was like, wow, someone's really sat and watched this back to work that out. Because, yeah, that is exactly what you're saying, Boyd. You'd never have got that coming up on TV.
No, it was route one stuff. I mean, yeah, it was old school, as I described on the breakdown. But I loved it. I really did. And there's so much sort of battling qualities on the show. But I was so pleased that my memories of Alan Smith playing well that night, not just scoring the goal, which was a great goal. We'll remember it forevermore. One of his best, really, I guess, in terms of quality, but his performance as a target man was unbelievable. It was, yeah. He won everything in the air. He held everything up. And because Palmer was so much better than us, we needed someone up top that we could just not boom the ball to, because they were sort of measured passes into him, but they had someone to relieve the pressure. And without Smudger that night, aside from the goal, Arsenal may well have been overwhelmed. They may well have conceded three or four goals, even though the defence were fantastic, just because they'd had to absorb so much. Smudger relieved it and gave everyone a breather. And yeah, it was nice, because he's such a nice fellow. You know, Smudger, he's great. He's so modest as well. So yeah, it was nice to big him up.
Sorry, Boyd. We were deliberately doing video that this bit wasn't going to happen, and now it's happened, Boyd. What I was going to say, actually, you go first, because you wanted to ask about Alan Smith, and I wanted to ask about something from the Man United game that Adrian did.
Oh, yeah, well, go on. I was just going to say about Alan Smith that watching the 89 film again on Friday, you're reminded of just what a legend he was, and I feel like underappreciated. Partly because he was so reliable and held the ball up so well, and like almost like was taken for granted. I think I felt like the way as a fan, you know, watching football at that time, he was just so dependable. But that is a real skill, holding the ball up and bringing everyone else in. And he did it so, you know, seemingly effortlessly. And because you're right, he's such a nice guy. He doesn't really look like a footballer, does he? Looks so kind of. I mean, with all due respect, like a librarian or something, you know. And I think that's why he's not a glamorous figure, but he was so dependable, so important, wasn't he?
Players loved him, yeah. And he was a good lad, you know. He wasn't boring. He was a really good personality. I think he'd join in, not all the time, with the fun and games that went on off the pitch. But I remember when he was in Hong Kong on that infamous post-season tour of Hong Kong and China, where Ray Parler was in prison when we came home after an altercation with a taxi driver in Hong Kong. But I remember one night, and we went out, we were going to China the next day on a flight, and we were told, look, just have a couple of beers and then go home. And it didn't happen. Once Stuart Houston went to bed, everyone went out, and I was still I was trying to be a goody-goody. I probably got in about 3, and we were up and out at say 7, and I was getting on the bus, having had a shower and everything, and Smudger and a few of the other boys were just coming back from the night out. So he had a little bit of a I mean, it was post-season, but he had a little bit of a naughty streak as well, which kind of made me like him even more.
Oh, that's good to know. And he's a really good pundit, and he's a good football journalist. He writes really good columns, doesn't he? So I think, yeah, he's
quite an inspiration to me, actually. Yeah. I mean, I love really playing with him, but the fact that he went into journalism, did his own stuff. There's none of this. He didn't have a ghostwriter. He was writing his own copy. And yeah, I definitely, as I was, you know, when I was looking at post football, I looked at Smudger definitely as someone to sort of follow in the footsteps of.
Just going on then to the game you against Man United, which was, you know, amazing to watch. And again, you see the ferocity of the game and the tackles and everything that was going on, which you sort of miss. Oh, I thought there was an amusing moment where you almost looked hesitant to refer to Ashley Cole. You were like, and Ashley Cole, who of course did go on to play for Chelsea, was really good. Are you sort of, is that in your head because of how he's now viewed by Arsenal fans? It's going out on the Arsenal website. You have to sort of frame it.
Yeah, because he's not well liked, is he? As a guy, I guess, because of the nature of the exit and who he ended up playing for. So yeah, I did sort of feel I had to preface it a little bit, and I just wanted to remind everybody how good he was when he was a Gooner, and he was brilliant, wasn't he? I think he is the. I mean, I loved playing with Nigel Winterburn, who was awesome, But I do think he probably shades at Ashley Cole. I mean, he was Ashley Cole at one point might have been the world's best left back. I think he was yeah. If he wasn't the best, he was in the top two. So and you couldn't have said that about Nigel, unfortunately. So he was probably the best left back we've ever had at Arsenal. And in this game, he was unreal. Really, I mean, there were some stellar performances. Edu and Vieira are amazing, in particular. But I think he won 7 of 8 tackles, according to the stats. And I just showed a few of them, and as you see, he just crunched into them. And that was the stat. That was one of the standout things of doing that game and the others, was actually how football's changed and how much physicality was a part of the game, and how we've lost it. And I have to say, in terms of watching football, I don't know how you guys feel, it was a more rounded spectacle and more entertaining, albeit more dangerous, when players were allowed to tackle with force and to even go tackle from behind at some point. I know that we don't like to see that or players get injured, but I think it added something to the overall watching experience. And it also bred a real competitiveness among the players. There seemed to be more aggressive footballers back then than there would be now. And what almost now, what's the point in having an aggressive footballer? Because you can't really tackle, can you? And yeah, watching these games back, it made me miss football from the 90s and the 2000s because, yeah, even though players would get injured, I felt that because football is a physical sport, I felt it was better.
There were more injuries bad back then, any terrible ones, any leg breakers and stuff, than there are now. In fact, it almost feels like the other way, that like you see more injuries now than back then. So, yeah, I agree with you, and I don't see what difference.
What about those United tackles, though?
Yeah, that I was going to say. You did then point out those absolutely, the Roy Keane one, on Vieira, where he's like his foot's like back in his throat. It was extraordinary. So you do, yeah. I mean, those were unbelievable tackles, but they just were all dealt with, weren't they? They weren't.
They weren't all yellows, I believe. Yeah, all four of those were yellow card offences. But I think at least three of them these days would have been reds. And United would have been down to 8. and I said it during the breakdown. I really did admire the way Arsenal didn't lose their heads. They complained and they berated the officials, but they sort of channeled their anger in a really calm and measured way. They used that frustration, that annoyance. It made them even more focused to win, and that is how you should. That's the sort of mindset that you should adopt, I guess. Too often we see individuals or players just lose their cool and boom, they're down to 10 men, aren't they? And the momentum's gone.
Adrian, I just wanted to come in because, as I think I mentioned, I sent you a little email before with notes. I've been going back watching a few of the old season reviews during this period. I haven't got quite as far as I hoped, but I've got through that period of seeing your role into the team. And I think you've probably spoken as well about how, you know, Bruce Rioch maybe showed more faith in you than maybe George Graham had. I just wanted to touch on it for a minute, having watched that one season, 95-96, you know, had Bruce Rioch stayed on, do you think you'd have stayed on at Arsenal and had more opportunities, or did you see potentially an exit coming regardless?
It's hard to tell. I think that I was always felt I was well thought of there under George Graham and all the backroom staff, and you know, but it was hard to get an opportunity under George Graham because he was defensive coach. The football was attritional, wasn't it? It wasn't all about the skill, although he had some really skillful wingers during his time there. Anders Limpar obviously was a standout one. But yeah, Bruce was I suppose more of a risk taker. He wanted to play slightly more expansively. He couldn't tolerate certain characteristics, I think, and some of the senior guys rubbed him up the wrong way, or they displeased him, and that opened the door for keen, eager youngsters like myself, I think, to have an opportunity. And I look back, and I think I played pretty well in most of the games that I was involved in. I didn't obviously do well enough to stay in the team long term, but I played pretty well. I probably should have scored a couple of goals. That might have made a difference. But no, what happened was it got to the business end of the season and Bruce Rioch changed tact. He went with wing backs for, I think it was a League Cup semi-final against Villa, and it worked. And wing backs didn't suit me. I would have had to have played in a different role, and I don't know whether they saw me as that player. So I was sort of frozen out on the basis of a system change at the end of that season. And then, of course, he left. And what happened was Wenger came in, picked up the first team squads that was left behind, and I was in the reserves at the point where Rioch had left, and that's kind of where I stayed, really. And yeah, it was really frustrating. I wish I'd had more chance to impress Arsene Wenger, that's for sure. I really do, because I think he would have liked a lot of aspects of my game, but ultimately, and I say this with brutal honesty, I wasn't quite good enough in hindsight to be a winger in his team. You look at Parler on one side, it was so powerful, and you had Overmars, who he brought in effectively instead of me, and he was just one of the best on the planet at that point. I couldn't live with them in terms of speed or power, and that 98 team was all about that. I think it was all about power and pace, and I just didn't fit in. And if truth be told, the quality of player that came in, your Vieiras, your Anelkas, Petit, Overmars, it would have been extraordinarily hard for so many players, not just me, to get a look in. So yeah, it was time to move on. Arsenal were going places, and I just hadn't quite done enough to prove I was worth staying. So no, I don't think I would have stayed in the long term. But I wish I'd played under Wenger, because maybe in a different position. Maybe I could have been a number 10 guy or played inside. But yeah, it wasn't to be.
That's interesting, isn't it, that a formation change kind of has such a huge effect on a player's career.
But I lost confidence off the back of it as well, because I was buzzing. I was living the dream. I was playing in the squad every week, really, on the bench. Sometimes I played, sometimes I started, and suddenly I was gone. And I was not only gone, I was in the reserves playing out of position in a position that I really felt uncomfortable in. As a left wing back, I was a bag of nerves, because I was used to having players behind me to help me defend, and all of a sudden I was on my own, and it just didn't suit me. And I should really have stuck my hand up and said, look, this isn't for me. I need to play at number 10 or up front or in central midfield. But I didn't. And my form sort of dipped and as my confidence waned. And Wenger came in, kept the same system for that first season. 96-97, and I didn't stand a chance.
But it seemed, just if I remember rightly, watching that season back, you came into the team around Christmas or December and were part of that team really for sort of 6 weeks, but that coincided with Arsenal not being in a great period of form, and that probably is what you're saying led to that change.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we didn't win that many games that I was involved in. My full debut was fantastic. We beat QPR 3-0, absolute joy. But yeah, it was a sort of rocky period for the team. We had a few players out injured. I don't think Dennis was available for all the games. But yeah, it was all right. It was enjoyable for me because it was so exciting, and it was a pleasure to be a part of. And I had some really sort of good moments, but also hard moments where you make a mistake and you got 38,000 people sort of moaning and groaning, something you have to sort of deal with as a young player. But yeah, look, I got to play for Arsenal. It was amazing. It was a tough journey to get there. One or two regrets in terms of wish I'd grabbed the opportunity by scoring and making some goals. And I think that would have made a difference. There was a 25-yarder. I don't know if it was on the review that you saw against Everton. I think it got save of the month from Neville Southall in Everton's goal. That goes in.
I think it was on.
Yeah, that goes in. And that probably gives me 10 more games, because you just scored from 25 yards. Managers then start to think, well, I'll keep him on. I'll keep him involved because he's capable of producing that. But of course, it's saved, and then it gets forgotten, and four weeks later, you're out of the team. So it's little crossroads moments, but yeah, ultimately, probably wasn't good enough. And I do look back and think I should have done extra. It wasn't really the culture, and it didn't upset me. But when I read about what happened at Manchester United, because they were all my age, the class of 92 with the Beckhams and Nevilles and Barton, you know, I knew these guys. When I found out about how they'd sort of been mentored by Fergie and how hard they'd worked behind the scenes, extra training, afternoons, it just made me wish, why didn't I do that? It wasn't, unfortunately, it wasn't the culture at Arsenal. Everyone went home at the end of training. It was like, we're done. Let's have some food. Let's get out of here. And I got swept up in that. And I do look back and think I could have done a bit more. But yeah, I think a lot of us probably could have done at that point.
That's interesting because I saw an interview with Arteta, did that interview with Ian Wright recently on the Adidas website and the Arsenal website. And I think he said something like, I didn't see many people pick up on it, but he said when he arrived, you know, as manager at Arsenal, he felt like there was a slight attitude problem. They weren't really working hard, and they weren't kind of doing the extra, as you say, doing that a little bit extra under the previous manager. Yeah. And he was surprised by that. That was interesting.
Well, you build things, and when good teams are being constructed and built and players feel like they're buying into something that they can belong to, I think people push each other, and that's when the positive culture starts. It's like, come on, us four, let's go and do a bit now. And you see it with all the successful teams. It happened, that 2002 team will have done that. You could tell by the performance. I think bad habits can become regular habits, can't they? And I think Arsenal's players, I don't know because I don't spend any time really at the training ground, but it looked from the outside that they'd become not a team of individuals, but there was an individual culture. Yeah. There wasn't that togetherness that you need to foster. Whether that was, you know, Unai Emery's fault or the personality traits of the individuals, I don't know. But yeah, hopefully Arteta, well, it sounds like he's picked up on it. And that's very encouraging, because the same group of players, if they have that individual mindset, you put them in an environment where you're a band of brothers, the same players with the same ability will always achieve more.
If you want an e-bike that doesn't look like it's made for the shopping precinct, something that's less Mr. Bean and more Steve McQueen, check out the range of bikes from London-based Cooler King. From dope 250-watt city bikes to Harley Bobber-inspired 750-watt beasts that can tear your face off while leaving your smile intact. Cooler Kings are made in limited numbers, yet highly affordable. Check them out now on the web at cooler.bike or find them on Instagram with hashtag CoolerKingBike. Cooler.bike. E-bikes that are cool AF.
Talking about players and the way they behave and the way they work together, if you're a player now, and you're faced with a situation where, you know, you don't know what's going to happen with football in the future. And it's such a weird moment of doubt that no professional footballer must surely have ever been in this position before. They literally don't know what's going to happen to their game in the next few months, let alone the next few weeks, let alone months. And then if the Premier League decides they're going to come back on the 6th of June or whatever, and the virus is still around, how would you feel? Would you be scared? What's your feeling about it? You know, do you think, oh yeah, no, we're going to go straight in, we're going to go back to playing football, or be it behind closed doors, it'll be fine. How would you feel about the whole thing?
I think that every player is different. They'd all feel different emotions. I probably would be one of the gullible ones that just gets sucked in and thinks, yeah, if they tell me it's safe, I believe them, and let's roll with it, because I just want to crack on and play football and do my job, because this is doing my head in. That's probably how I'd look at it. But it depends on your scenario, doesn't it? If you've got a family member that's got a health problem, underlying, you know, issue, then it makes the prospect of catching COVID-19 that bit scarier, doesn't it? And bringing it home. So there'll be players out there that are scared, definitely. Mm-hmm. But overall, I think that they'll be talked round. But they have to. The problem at the moment is, and if I was a player right now, I'd be a bit angry, is that I feel the players are being left out of the conversation. And it's almost as if, well, they'll play. They'll be fine. Mm-hmm. They'll do what they're told because we pay them thousands of pounds a week, and they'll just have to lump it. And I think that there's a real resentment there at the moment among pros. So it could be an uprising, but I would imagine that they'll be sweet talked into it. And let's be fair, when these games do start, and hopefully they will, the grounds will be the safest place to be, and they will be tested thoroughly. And I would imagine life in general, the three of us here, everyone, we're going to have to get on with some kind of normal life, and it's all going to be about calculated risks, isn't it? And I think playing football is going to count as a calculated risk, and that's the message I think that will be sold.
I agree. Yeah.
They'll get on with it. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree, and I think interestingly, in the last, since we've been in this opposition, and the whole project restart thing has been slowly, and with big meetings today, we'll talk about that in a minute. But there's been a slight, I've been slightly annoyed, but there's been like a big, like, moralistic wave among some fans and pundits. You know, like, I won't even, those of us who kind of want football to come back and, like, honestly go, look, I really miss it. I really want to see them somehow work out a way of bringing football back, albeit obviously behind closed doors. And they're going, oh, you know, how dare you talk about football? And it's the Premier League's just trying to make money, and all the clubs are trying to make money when people are dying every day. But as far as I'm concerned, it's like, life's not like that. You don't kind of go, oh, because this terrible thing is happening, then we can't possibly think about bringing this. And it's a hugely important industry. It's like any industry, isn't it?
It's huge.
It employs hundreds of thousands of people. Mm. People's livelihoods are at stake. And I'm not at the top end. I'm talking about the middle and, you know, lower rungs of employment, if you like. And it's ridiculous not to try and bring this huge thing back, albeit try and be safe about it. And
It's very easy, isn't it? You can earn a standing ovation for the moral crusade and say, how can you think about playing football? And, you know, it's vulgar to even think about it. But the truth is,
this little break.
The infection rate is going to gradually go down, and the landscape will change. And you can't then just go bang, okay, it's all right to play football now. You have to plan. You have to talk about these things, and that's why we're doing it now. And it's also worth billions of pounds, and that definitely matters. But I also get the fact that it will lift people. It will give everyone something to talk about. Give me a bit of work, thank goodness. as a freelancer at the moment, working in football, it's not exactly a great time. So we give those of us that work in the industry something to get stuck into. But no, I think it's been handled a bit shabbily at times. I think the communication's been a bit off. I don't really like the way leaks have come out. No one's taken ownership of the situation, have they? Clubs have been very, very coy. I mean, you're barely getting an opinion out of anyone at a football club at the moment. And I think that's because there's so many unknowns. No one wants to put their foot in it and say something they regret down the line. So I just hope that clubs can put their self-interest aside and agree on a way to restart. Personally, maybe we'll get to it in a minute. Personally, I hate the idea of neutral venues. I don't get it. In Germany, they trust their own fans not to turn up. And they trust the clubs. And this is where I think each club has a role to play. They trust the club that's staging the game. So, you know, Arsenal will have to entertain Liverpool at some point. They would, Arsenal at that point will... We'll send messages, you know, they'll do a campaign around not turning up to the game. You know, they'll stress the importance of it, and there'll be a cordon around the Emirates of, you know, okay, probably not police, but they'll get some stewards there where you can just cordon off the stadium just to make sure it's all okay. I think it's totally doable. And the neutral venue thing just creates such a mess and so much legal wrangling potentially. I don't think it's worth it.
I didn't get the neutral venue thing from the start. I don't know about you, Josh, but I didn't even understand like why, what the reason for it. I thought it was like some kind of safety technical reason that, you know, if you kept them all in a certain small number of venues or something. But then it turned out, you're right, it's all about them not trusting supporters to turn up during a game behind closed doors and do what? Stand outside the stadium drinking? And who would do that? I don't even, like, I know some football fans can be morons, but in any walk of life, groups of people can be. But why? I just don't see hundreds of fans turning up outside or behind a closed match. It seems ridiculous. Josh?
I agree with your wider point, but let's say Arsenal, I mean, this is really dream world, but say we were in Liverpool's position and Arsenal were on the verge of a title. Do you really think there wouldn't be Arsenal fans heading around the stadium, up Holloway Road, all around the stadium? Because that's what the Liverpool mayor ultimately came out and said. And said, look, we don't, you know, Ian Ferdy didn't want the games at Anfield because of that fear. Mm. You know, you've got a club who haven't won the title in 30 years and we'll do it at some point. And if that game takes place at Anfield, there's going to be people who, you know, will argue, oh, I was standing 2 metres away from the next fan, from the next fan, the next fan. And suddenly you're going to have thousands of people trying to line the roads in some way. And I don't think that is manageable. So I think that's where that came from. But I agree with what Adrian was saying. Once you have a competition that is no longer the same competition, and you don't have to be a statistician and the brightest spark at Opta to go, well, on average, how many points do clubs get at home and how many club points do the clubs get away? There is clearly, for whatever reason, a home advantage, and Adrian's better place to talk about
that. Even without a crowd, because but I've heard this argued that, oh yeah, but you lose home advantage when, because you lose the roar of your own fans. No, I'm telling you now, it's more an environment thing. It's you're used to that pitch and you're used to pictures in your mind on that pitch. When you go away from home, where you might visit that place once in 12 months, everything's a little bit alien. It didn't make that much difference, but it's the small margin. So I still firmly believe that home advantage will, when it happens, and if they are played at home grounds, I think more teams will win at home than they would away still. But yeah, so hopefully it does sound that this meeting today, there was widespread objection to that. So fingers crossed they can go back to the government, go back to the police and persuade them, look, football doesn't want this. Is there a way around it? So fingers crossed on that.
Yeah, it does sound like the guidance from the clubs is, if we are going to finish this, we'd like to finish it in the way that, you know, Germany are. I don't know if you saw, Boyd, I know you've been busy watching all sorts of Arsenal programming, but on the BBC website, I think it was Sunday morning, they were showing a live stream of a South Korean game, now the South Korea, and they were pumping songs into the stadium to create some kind of atmosphere. Yeah. I mean, there'll be critics who will argue doing that might not be too far away from how it can be at the Emirates on a quiet afternoon. What do you think about that? Do you think, Adrian, that's what they might do? You know, 1-0 Arsenal go ahead and we start hearing like 1-0 to the Arsenal around the stadium?
I don't think it's the most bizarre thing I've heard. I mean, it's better than having half-hour halves, isn't it? To 30-minute times. I mean, what's that all about? Goodness me.
I think that was just Gordon Taylor, wasn't it? I don't think anyone else even mentioned it.
It was total madness. Piping, crowd noise in. Personally, I'd probably prefer it. The issue as well, players swear. Players swear a lot. And if you're broadcasting these games, you don't want the commentators every couple of minutes apologising for players swearing. So it might help to actually have some kind of background hum or noise or whatnot. I don't know. I mean, I think it's an opportunity to be creative. I've seen Mönchengladbach have got fans to buy cardboard cutout of themselves, haven't they? Which I think is a great idea, and they manage going to charity and whatnot, and it will just look better than empty seats, in my opinion. So, I think it's going to be a bit soulless, and that, actually, I'm a bit worried that people will be turned off of football behind closed doors eventually. Initially, it'd be exciting, and then people will think, it's not for me, and then we might actually lose people in terms of their passion for the game. They might think, well, actually, football without supporters isn't that great. The plus side of that is, when fans are allowed back in, they will be appreciated, I hope, never before. And I hope that ticket prices will be lowered once fans are allowed back in. And I really hope that the broadcasters and clubs alike will start putting the fans a bit higher up on their list of priorities, because they're going to realise very quickly how important supporters are.
I just remember when they were redoing the North Bank, there was that mural, wasn't there?
Yeah, Blake. Yeah.
Where is it, Adrian? Who's still got it? Maybe we can get it back up and get it behind one of the goals.
Well, there was rumour then that there was a bit of fan music piped in, or fan chanting piped into that corner. I don't know if that was right, Boyd.
I remember that rumour, yeah.
Yeah, it was weird. I think I played a few youth games. I was quite young at the time, but yeah, it was... it was odd, but it was better than kicking the ball into a building site, wasn't it? Bit of creativity. I quite like it.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say just a question. I was about, you know, Adrian touched upon there being a freelancer in this football world. Are you starting to think, Adrian, about being asked to go back and do co-coms or be in a football stadium environment and sit 2 metres away from the lead commentator? Have you had any of those discussions or thoughts about that or concerns, or are you just hoping to get back to it?
Yeah, no, I haven't had conversations. But look, when it happens, I think I'll be comfortable enough to do it. Yeah, I trust that everyone will be spaced out, and it doesn't worry me. But although maybe it will at the time. Maybe it will. It depends what's going on in the world at that time. I did do a bit of work down at TalkSport when the lockdown came in, and I live in the Midlands now. I live in sort of in the sticks in a village. You feel very safe here, really. It's kind of not exactly a hotbed of a virus, and you're in your bubble and it's all fine. But then having to go down to London, I must admit, I felt a bit nervous, and I was sanitizing my hands every few minutes, and it was uncomfortable, and I'm glad I'm not down there at the moment working. I'm having to do work from home, but yeah, hopefully by the time football comes back, the world will look a little bit better. And we'll all be more at ease. So, fingers crossed.
Yeah. I think I live in the most viral place in the country.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because I'm in Southwark. I'm pretty sure we have the highest rate of
That's near TalkSport, isn't it? Yeah, London Bridge.
Yeah, it is near TalkSport, yeah. Don't come anywhere near me. I'm just going to be fascinated. Because I did watch, funnily enough, a bit of that Korean game. And everything, and it was still all the things you worry about, like they're not going to want to come within, you know, 2 meters of each other and all that. And, you know, it was definitely worth watching. Like, you know, I definitely felt if this was a Premier League game, let alone one, I'd love to watch it. And as you say, even though the fan element is obviously huge, it's not the same, it's different. But it's still, like, I still can't wait for that first Premier League game to come back, to be able to watch it on TV.
I hope there's a bit of ingenuity as well, Boyd, in terms of the coverage. Yeah. There's talk about dressing rooms and cameras and whatnot. You know, maybe that'd be good. I don't know if the managers would be delighted with that. But yeah, if they jazz it up, I think in terms of their coverage, it will make a difference. And yeah, I think they have to because the whole experience will look so different. You know, I've played in front of empty stadiums so many times, like with reserve games and youth games down the years. You know, you get used to it, but a lot of these guys have not experienced it for years. You know, senior guys that have been at the top of the game for ages, it'll be a bit of a shock to the system. And I'll tell you what, it wouldn't surprise me if the form of certain individuals is impacted by empty stadiums. Some players will be able to block it out and they'll be fine. Others, I think, I'm not saying they're going to go to pieces, but we might see some quite iffy displays by players just weirded out by the surroundings.
Do you think the managers though will find it easier to communicate? Because I always think when I see managers, like, I mean, Emery used to spend the whole game trying to tell the players what to do. Like, literally, like, you go there, and I was like, how can they possibly pay any attention to it? Now with Arteta being such, and he kind of often, doesn't he? He kind of grabs. I remember him grabbing Saka quite a lot as a young, you know, wide player, kind of literally telling him what to do quite a lot. Usually, it's easy to communicate if there isn't a huge crowd noise. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, as a former winger, I used to get it in the neck all the time. I was the one that had to pass on messages, or I was the only one that would shout out because you were the only one that could hear. So yeah, maybe other players we had to hear the managers this time around. I mean, did the Korean managers have to wear masks? Did I see that? Did they wear masks?
Yeah, I think they were.
Yeah, I mean, were that?
I'm not sure if they had to. I think it's just it's such a part of Korean culture anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
I think they're all wearing masks, going about their work business anyway, whatever they do. Yeah.
The whole thing about celebrating as well, I don't know if you saw that report where, I mean, I can get the spitting would be banned, you know, let's not spit at each other.
The celebrations was weird because they did hold back,
having group celebrations, come on, if you're going to have football, normal football, then you're going to have grappling at set plays, at corners, let the lads celebrate. I mean, they'll use common sense. I don't think there'll be the usual bundles, but I think you can allow them to celebrate in a relatively normal way. That you can go over the top. And remember, at training, they're going to have to. You can't go into a match self-isolating in training. There will have to be a point where it's like normal. And otherwise, you know, it'd just be too alien. So, and that's where players are just going to have to trust that the testing is fine, and that they are going to be safer than, you know, or as safe as anyone else.
Just to get your longer term outlook here, Adrian, do you believe the Premier League season will be finished? I can't help but think, maybe I'm being cynical, but if you're one of those bottom six, and it is really difficult at the moment because the bottom six, if they put out a statement, everyone's going, oh, you're only saying that because you might go down, and everyone's got their self-interest. But if you are one of those bottom six and you are in danger of going down, you've got every reason to want a player in your squad or a couple of players in your squad to contract a virus that then means you can go, well, we can't possibly play this game.
Well, they could be sitting. Yeah, look, I'd like to think no one will switch a hamstring injury to a key player for a positive test. It's not beyond the realms of possibility, is it? That, oh, we can't play this game because we've got a positive test. But I don't think that will happen. I think there are two scenarios that could see the season stops. I think if it is stopped, they'll go points per game and it'll be tough and they'll still have relegation. I don't want to have weighted points per game because every team's different at the home and away. Like, some teams are stronger at home. I just think the fairest way is just points per game. Two scenarios. One is that there's a vote. The Premier League put forward, this is the proposal, and it the alternative is we stop the season here and now, and that vote doesn't go the right way. And therefore, they have to do a points per game just to wrap it up. Or if we agree to kickstart it and there's a sudden outbreak and players are going down with the illness left, right and centre, then I think it would be stopped. And then I think we have to do points per game. So look, even when we do start, and hopefully we'll start mid-June, I don't think any of us can relax and assume it's going to finish. Because there could be a flare-up, and if there's a flare-up, they'll stop it. They have to, because public opinion, the PR own goal of carrying on, it wouldn't be right. So it's a lottery, I think, really.
Yeah, it's on a knife edge, isn't it? What's going to happen? Mm. But that bottom six you're talking about, Josh, that was really all about the neutral venue thing, wasn't it, as well? So, and if now they seem to be saying today, like the head of the FA, I think, said, or that actually all the Premier League clubs don't want to play neutral. They want to play home and away. They don't want to play neutral venues. So that maybe that whole issue is going to go away, disappear. I don't know.
But there was those comments, I think, from Dean Smith, the Aston Villa manager, was it last week, speaking about, you know, one of his members of his squad having, I think, a mother-in-law living with them who they're caring for. I mean, how do you tell that player that he's got to come into work and face the risk of that? We've seen Brighton announce an unnamed player get the virus, like, now, when we're supposedly, you know, way over the peak of this virus. I don't know. It just seems, you know, is it convenient? It's the Aston Villa manager. It's very harsh to say that. Brighton, who have been very vocal on going, if we're doing this, you know, they've been one of the few clubs that have actually had someone speaking on their behalf really eloquently and saying, this is what we believe.
But a player that's uncomfortable, I think, because they'll be quite rare, in terms of that situation, I think it would just, they'll make themselves unavailable as if it's, you know, as if they're ill or unwell or, you know, a family bereavement, you know, there are reasons why players miss games. And that might be the case with certain individuals. There's also the contract thing to clear up. I know that this meeting today, it was agreed that contracts will be, that end on June the 30th, will be amended so that they end at the end of this season. Now, the players have to have a say in this, and not every player will agree to that. I'm telling you now, because every player has their own story. And for every guy that's loving life, that thinks their club is brilliant, there's another one that feels like they've been mistreated or stitched up. And you really think that they want to do, you know, put themselves at risk in terms of getting injury, knowing that they'll be leaving the club at the end of the season. There'll be players that say, nah, not for me. And again, so that will warp it. But I just think it's imperfect. We have to deal with it, right? I mean, I don't think we can stop the season on the basis that a few out of contract players don't want to make themselves available. I think we just have to take that on the chin. Yeah, it'd be fascinating to see how the players do respond who are out of contract. Yeah.
Just one question, I guess, about Arsenal that seemed to be in the news today was about Danny Ceballos, Adrian, about there seemingly not being the appetite to turn this into a permanent transfer or see this go to next year, but there is a hope that he stays with the club through to the end of the season. Do you think that's, from what you've seen of him this season, a shame that he won't be staying with the club as it seems?
If I was the manager, I would be doing exactly the same thing. Yeah, I would love him to stay for the rest of the season because he was coming into some good form, actually. I thought he was playing some of his best stuff outside of his debut, which is brilliant. Was it his debut? I can't remember if it was his debut, but one of his first games against Burnley.
Yeah.
It was just superb, wasn't he? It was sublime.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
Never replicated that, unfortunately.
No.
Was coming into some good form, but hand on heart, I don't think he's done enough to earn a permanent deal or certainly to justify Arsenal spending a lot of money on him this summer. And my reasoning is not because he's not talented, because he clearly is. I think it's a style thing. And he's not got great legs. And that sounds like maybe a really basic thing to say. He's not got a great engine, quite slow. And on the ball, that's not such a big deal. But in the position he plays, under Arteta, is one of two central midfielders. They've both got to be athletic, especially the way Arteta plays the game. When play breaks down, they've got to be able to sprint back into position. And unfortunately, when we lose the ball, he's treading water a lot of the time. And there is a hole. He works hard and he eventually gets there and he's done some great defensive work. But the way Arteta wants to play football, high intensity, really aggressive, I don't think he's the central midfielder for him. At 10, maybe, but he hasn't used him there, so he obviously doesn't see him as that kind of player. I don't know what you think. I don't know if you agree or not, but
yeah,
that's the way I see it.
Yeah. Also, because if he's going to play Ozil, you know, who also isn't very fast, but in the number 10 role, he can't have both two players, kind of creative players, I guess, who are both quite slow and,
Ozil's quicker across the ground than right. Ceballos. He's just got sort of longer legs, and I think he's quite a graceful runner. Ceballos is just really good on the ball, isn't he? He's like Santi Cazorla. Yeah. Santi Cazorla wasn't rapid, but it kind of worked. I don't think it. Maybe it's because he's alongside Xhaka, who's also not super quick, right, particularly on the turn. Yeah. I just feel that we need athletes in there, and I mean, that's why I've been linked with the Atletico player Thomas Partey. What Arteta wants is an athlete that's also got the technique of Ceballos, and probably a bit more Ramsey about them. Someone who can get in the box. I've been slightly disappointed with Ceballos in that regard. I thought he scored more goals, and he holds back. I want to, if you're playing next to Xhaka, I want to see you five, six times a game, maybe five, six times a half, getting in the box, and he doesn't do that.
No, fair enough. Yeah, fair enough. We've nearly run out of time, haven't we, Josh? It's been a joy having you on, Adrian.
It's been good.
Thank you very much. Josh, any last-minute things you want to mention before we go?
No, not particularly, Boyd. Have you got any great TV tips for us? Because people also come to you for that. Anything we should be watching during lockdown?
Make a shout.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, you know that ITV4, I think, is showing all of the Euro 96 matches.
Which is starting tonight, I think.
Starting tonight. Yeah, there's one on right now. Yeah, England's match is on now. Which I think is, I know a lot of people get faintly bored about these classic matches, but I still do find some enjoyment. So that's quite interesting. I find the punditry as interesting as the actual match. So when they showed the 79 Cup final, which I remember very clearly watching as a kid, I was 12, just listening to Brian Clough as a pundit on that match was as fascinating as actually the match itself, because he's such a funny character, and just seeing what people say. So that's interesting. Non-football based stuff on TV. There's loads of stuff. Gangs of London is what everyone should watch. That's incredible.
I've series linked it, Boyd.
It's fantastic. It's phenomenal. Yeah, and I think probably if you can take the ultra violence, it is one of the most violent things I've ever seen. Then it's still, no, you don't like.
No, I can. It doesn't bother me, but Mrs. Clark, she's not a big fan of the violent stuff. So I'll have to find. I'll have to watch that solo then.
You have to do it on your own time. Yeah, it is honestly it's the goriest thing I've ever seen on television. So Mrs. Clark will have to, I think, have to find her own entertainment, so to speak. Thanks so much for being on, Adrian. Now, thanks, Josh. And I guess we'll be back this time next week, won't we?
Absolutely.
No, appreciate it, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Adrian.
Bye.
Wasn't that a great podcast? Now, if you've got 90 seconds spare in your day, come and listen to ours. It's called What Has He Said Now? And is available wherever you got this podcast.
You're going to lose a number of people to the flu.
This is a Playback Media production. To listen to all our football podcasts, visit playbackmedia.co.uk.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.